theyeshiva.net.
Morning, Dr. Abalon. It's a pleasure and honor to be with you.
Likewise. Hey. Good morning. Nice to see you as
thank
well.
Thank you. Thank you.
So good morning, everyone. We are going to start. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us again this morning. My name is Yochanan Polter. I'm a co-founder and executive director of Fresh Start, and it's an honor and zchus for us to continue hosting this webinar series, bringing together Jews from all over the world and all different backgrounds. When Fresh Start opened a few short years ago, our goal was to provide services and programming to help Klal Yisrael heal from the past experience, including childhood abuse, trauma, and neglect. But here we are today. The traumas in the present and the current events in Eretz Yisrael and around the world are causing many of us to feel anxiety, fear, and a host of other emotions and possibly behaviors we thought we buried a long time ago. So we hope this webinar series will help all of us navigate these challenging times, both for ourselves and for our children, hence the reason Dr. Abalon is joining us today. Today's webinar will be focused on helping our children navigate challenging times. To learn more about Fresh Start, please visit JewishFreshStart.com. I would also like to thank our anonymous sponsor who has actively sponsored this webinar series, Le'iluy Nishmas Daniel Ben Esther, Rafael Ben Leah, Mayor Yehuda Ben Yosef Akayan, and in honor of Tzedek Elio and Ellie Seligson, two pillars of the Detroit community. Joining us today, we have the tremendous host to be joined by Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, who needs no introduction. I hope you're okay with that, Rabbi Y.Y.
I feel like he heard that so many times. Ushi doesn't introduce him anymore. We don't introduce
those
him
are
anymore.
The best introductions.
Okay.
Thanks.
Also the safest. We are also joined by Mrs. Tova Korn, co-founder and program director of Fresh Start. And, of course, Dr. Abalon. And, Dr. Abalon, I'm happy to tell you that your last webinar with us and Rabbi Y.Y. went, at least in our community, viral. I know it's been viewed thousands and thousands of times. I got amazing feedback. I think, Rabbi Y.Y., you got meaningful feedback. So it's an honor to have you. Dr. Abalon is founder and director of Think Kids in the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General Hospital. He's also an associate professor in child and adolescent psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and he's the author of three books, Changeable, The School Discipline Fix, and Treating Explosive Kids. We will allow, the goal of today is to have a discussion, then open it up for some Q&A, which we'll moderate and monitor. And with that being said, Rabbi Y.Y., perhaps lead off this discussion and take it away.
Yeah. So, as everybody knows, the Jewish people face profound adversity since October 7th, 2023. Of course, the Jews living in Israel, but really Jews around the world who have been shocked and stunned by an explosion of horrific anti-Semitism that no Jew imagined, especially in the United States of America. Not from everybody, they're very good people, but from enormous amounts of groups and, you know, places of academia and journalism where you would expect some ethical refinement. So it's a very difficult time for the Jewish people, a very difficult time. We've been around for 4,000 years, so we know what works. What works for us is unity, spiritual and emotional fortitude, faith, love, connectedness, resolve, courage, confidence, being anchored in real spiritual truth and in moral clarity. But all of us, you know, want to really become the best version of ourselves. You know, times of war, times of adversity bring out the worst in some people and the best in other people. One of the things that always moved me about Dr. Stuart Abalon's ideology when it comes to education, and we discussed it at length in the last webinar, and this morning I refreshed myself with your TED Talk that you gave a few years ago, the 19 or 18 minute brilliant TED Talk, was something that always resonates with me, because one of the key principles in Judaism and Torah is to be able to identify that in each child there's infinite goodness. And our job as parents and educators is to polish the diamond and cultivate it. And one of Dr. Abalon's powerful ideas is, instead of looking at the children and say, wow, you're such a troublemaker. You really don't want to do it. Huh? You really want to make your parents miserable, don't you? You want to make your siblings miserable, don't you? You want to destroy everybody's lives. Instead, it's looking at the child and seeing that there's an innocence, there is a purity, there's a holiness. For Judaism, that's a core teaching, that every one of us has a soul that is literally divine, and it's whole, it's untarnished, it's splendid, it's sacred, it's amazing. We also have blockages, and we also have other forces inside of us, and we all need to choose, you know, which space we're going to live in with ourselves and with our children. Never mind when we're dealing with trauma, one of the, I think, the most powerful effects of trauma is that we don't get to know how beautiful we are. We don't get to know how soulful we are, how much love we have in our hearts, because of a message that creeps into our brain internally and often externally from people or events or experiences around us that eclipse that. And, you know, today I think is such a powerful opportunity to be able to go into that space with ourselves and with our children. And Dr. Ablon, you know, always teaches how, you know, if we should always be able to identify that goodness in our child and help him or her bring that out. So I think today we want to really focus on how we can be here for our children in the profoundest way, to be able to give them tools that will allow them to use this time and this crisis really as a catalyst to become the people that they're capable of becoming, which we believe every person is capable of becoming an ambassador of love and light and kindness and beauty and hope and healing. So here we are today, and thank you. Thank you to Fresh Start. Thank you, Rabbi Yochanan. Thank you, Tov. And of course, thank you, Dr. Ablon. And thank you for everybody that's joining us here, and all those who will watch it later. And it's really a pleasure and an honor. So maybe we should give the mic to our esteemed guest to be able to make a presentation, and then we can take it from there.
Sure. Well, thank you. First of all, let me say I appreciate the invitation to join you all today and the community for this discussion. And I'm really hoping it's going to be just that, a discussion. And I'm hoping that discussion will be helpful to folks. I will reiterate something that you just mentioned, Rabbi, which is, you know, in my work, we have a saying. We say that kids do well if they can, not kids do well if they want to. And it's as simple as we just have to make them want to, but rather kids do well if they can, because what we believe is all kids want to do well. I have yet to meet a child who prefers struggling to doing well. And so we really feel like every child is striving to be the best version of themselves. And when they're struggling, it's very infrequently a lack of motivation that would be getting in their way. Usually what it is in our language is a lack of being able to access the skills they would need to be able to navigate what the world is throwing at them. And I think as we gather today to talk about how to be helpful to our children, to support them during enormously difficult times, I think the first thing for us to discuss is how to support one another. Because the reality is that most of the stress, this chronic stress that is being felt throughout your community is being felt by the adults, by the parents, by the educators. Now, that doesn't mean it's not also being felt by the children, because children are incredible emotional barometers. You know, we often have this thought that we can shield children from things, especially by not talking to them about things, or talking to them, you know, talking in front of them, or from shielding them from inputs from TV, from social media. Children sense things. Children understand things at a level we really don't give them credit for. So frankly, there isn't shielding from children. As much as we like to think we're capable of it, we're really not. And they're barometers of our anxiety, our stress, our moods, you know, what we're preoccupied with. So I think, you know, the first important focus for us is how does everyone be there together with one another to support one another? Because the reality is that during very dysregulating times, to use a sort of clinical term, you know, if we're going to be there to try to help regulate our children, help them manage and control their behaviors and understand their feelings behind those behaviors, it starts with us being able to manage our own reactions, responses, emotions, and yes, as a result, behavior. You know, there's a sort of a fundamental truth that is often shared in my field, which is that a dysregulated adult cannot possibly help regulate a dysregulated child. And it's not just adult to children, you know, that there we talk about there's an inherent power differential of sorts. But the reality is that no dysregulated person can help regulate another person.
So help us regulate ourselves so we can regulate others.
That's where I'm heading. Where I'm heading is, you know, I often tell people that, you know, there's lots of different ways to regulate ourselves and help regulate one another. There are what we call top down and bottom up ways, talking about the top or the bottom of the brain. You know, there are ways that are frequently talked about that are sort of more bottom up, if you will, which involves just literally taking care of yourself. Which means, you know, watching your sleep, your eating, your exercise, your getting outside, you know, these kinds of things to stay regulated. But when we're talking about strategies, that you can use to help regulate another human, look, I tell people, the greatest human regulator we have is empathy. Empathy is tremendously regulated. And so a large part of my work and the folks who utilize our work is about teaching people how to become better empathizers. And you know, sometimes people think, well, that's just sort of a skill you have or you don't. Some people are just super empathic and others are not. And while that's truth to that, you know, I've never seen a skill that can't be built of any kind. And I'm not saying that somebody who struggles with a skill is going to become fantastic at that skill overnight, but there's no skill that can't be practiced and developed over time. And even I'm not just talking about kids' brains that are more malleable, but the adult brain is changeable also. So anybody can learn to get better at empathizing. And so I guess what I'd like to just unpack and then hopefully we can, you know, involve people in the discussion here is what does empathy mean? And to me, empathy means to understand. It doesn't mean that you have to have walked in somebody's shoes to be able to empathize with them. And it certainly does not mean that you have to agree with their perspective entirely or point of view or things like that. But you do have to work really hard to try to understand. And I think one of the things that I would imagine is in this community, people are having very different reactions and responses. I'm sure there's commonality and similarity, but we want to be careful not to assume that our reaction, our response, our emotions are the same reactions, responses, emotions that someone else is feeling. And how can you check? Well, you can get curious. And you can think of yourself as a detective, really trying to understand what somebody's reactions, points of views, responses are. And so it's really about being open-minded, being curious, being non-judgmental, and really just wanting to talk and understand what somebody's experience is. And last thing I'll say for now is just last week I was at a conference for schools. A conference focused on what people refer to as social emotional learning in schools. And I was doing a presentation along with a colleague of mine who focuses a lot on helping people understand, express, and manage their emotions. His name's Dr. Mark Brackett. Has a wonderful book, by the way, called Permission to Feel, which is a great book. But he has a particular approach he works with in, folks in schools around. But one of the things that he was really emphasizing in our joint work last week is that we often make a lot of assumptions about people's emotions. Because when we're reading people's emotions, it comes entirely through our own filter, through our own experiences. And, you know, that can be very helpful, but it can also produce, you know, some assumptions. You know, I think there a long time ago, somebody wrote a paper where they distinguished between what we call blind spots and bright spots. And blind spots is, you know, when because of your own experiences, your own upbringing, background, et cetera, you might have some particular blind spots. Everybody understands that concept. The concept of bright spots was if you have people with shared experiences, values, cultures, perspectives, you also have to be really careful of your bright spot, which is making assumptions that we are so aligned that I know exactly how you're thinking and feeling about this. And that's a mistake. And the biggest reason that it's a mistake is it misses an opportunity to gather information and really understand, and maybe you're exactly aligned. But you know what? If you really take the time and the patience and the curiosity to understand and find out you're aligned, that will be immensely regulating. It's not just being aligned is what's regulating. It's having someone listen to you and understand you, really while trying to sort of bite their tongue on their perspective or point of view or experience while they just try to explore what's going on for the other person. So I thought that might be a useful place for us to start. And obviously there's a lot more that
How do you deal with the anger? Like I find myself, say, hearing or seeing somebody of influence or trying to be uttering just a monstrous lie. You know, Hitler once said, don't tell people a small lie. They won't believe you. Tell them a monstrous lie, and then, oh, of course it's true, you know, it can't be not true. And I find myself getting so angry, I don't know, helpless or angry. Now, sometimes maybe that's the right emotion. Like, maybe that's the right emotion.
But
it's very dysregulating.
It is very dysregulating. But, you know, there's a notion out there that there's, like, positive and negative emotions, which is a silly thought. You know, there's hard emotions and easier emotions, but you know, it's not feeling anger is not a negative emotion. Anger is an incredible indicator. And what you need to be thoughtful about, of course, is, you know, trying your best to sort of inhibit the impulse to immediately react from anger and try to really understand, okay, why is this angering me so much? And let me make sure I understand my own personal reaction to this and think about how I want to express that. And of course, what I want to do with those feelings, because I want to be very clear also that the notion of emotion regulation, it does not mean that you should always be controlling your emotions. No, emotions can be very helpful to drive us to do things that need to be done in the world. And so, you know, managing emotions is not always to quell emotions. Anger can be a very useful and indicator and emotion for us to drive action.
You're saying you just want to make sure you're harnessing it productively to help, to help the cause of goodness.
Yes, exactly.
Now, when you see a child, if I could just get very practical, and maybe it's not a question on principle, it's very practical. Let's say, you know, you see a child, your child is at home. You ask him questions or her questions, no answer. all they want is computer or whatever, just leave me alone. You're trying to communicate. You're trying to build a relationship. It's not just resistance in behavior. It's resistance that you can't even begin to build the communication level. So, yeah, you go to Dr. Ablin, he says there's a skill missing. It's not rebellion. He's not trying to destroy your life. He's not a bad kid. How do you even begin to build that skill when your child is just ignoring you or throwing a tantrum and they don't want to talk to you?
Well, yeah, a bunch of things for us to unpack here. I mean, first of all, that could be a struggle with skill. You know, perhaps the easiest, simplest example is, you know, a lot of kids have difficulty with the language and communication skills necessary to take in everything that you're saying to them with receptive language and formulate their thoughts in a sort of coherent and effective and quick enough way and communicate them back to you. And one of their ways to avoid having that challenge is just not to engage at all. And, you know, I'm always struck by, and I have three children myself, I'm struck by how often when we go to try to talk to children, if we don't get a fairly quick response that suggests they're engaging in the communication, we throw more words at them very quickly. And oftentimes we sort of throw more words at them with more intensity. And if we still don't get a response, we remind them that if they don't respond to us, there's going to be some consequence to this. So in other words, then what we do is we throw emotion on top of something that is already hard for them. And it's no surprise they shut down or escalate. So sometimes it can absolutely be a skill. I will say, though, that there are other times where, you know, a child might have the skills to fully engage in that conversation. But frankly, they've had a lot of examples of those conversations sounding a whole lot more like lectures than conversations, again, which every parent has been a part of. You know, when you, sometimes you're lecturing and you know you're lecturing, you don't want to lecture, but you can't stop yourself from lecturing. So a lot of times, you know, there's also a thought of, oh, I know where this is heading. And, you know, this is not going to, this is not going to be something that I'm going to find it engaging or fulfilling at all. So, you know, of course, I have some thoughts about this. One, on a very practical level, I encourage us parents to be really thoughtful about when and where and while doing what we try to have conversations like this, especially difficult conversations. You know, every child has their preferences for times and places to have conversations. You know, I remember when my three children were younger, they had three entirely different sort of times and places, and frankly, activities. We, you know, a big mistake we make is we often think that a serious conversation must be sitting down at a table or on chairs, looking at each other face to face. It's extraordinarily dysregulating for children to do that. And they often start to dissociate as a response, which is part of the reasons you don't get engagement. One of the best things you can do to regulate is to have some motion or some activity. This is why taking a walk with your child and talking is far more effective. First of all, there's not constant eye contact, which is dysregulated, but there's motion, there's movement. Patterned, repetitive movement regulates our human brains. And so whether that's taking a walk, you know, with older children, when you're driving in the car with them, again, you're not looking face to face at one another. There's some movement, a little bit of distraction, throwing a ball back and forth, you name it, but some other activity. I'll tell you, you know, the reason why therapists who work with children and adolescents almost always have the game of Uno in their offices is because Uno can be played without using a lot of brain power. But there's also a patterned and repetitive back and forth that goes on, which regulates the brain and provides a little distraction while you can have a conversation at the same time. So sorry for my long-winded answer here, but first off, I would say, where should you have this conversation? When are they at their best for these conversations? Is it at night before bed? Is it while having a snack? Is it in the while they're in the bath? Is it outside throwing a ball? Is it taking a walk? And, you know,
eating ice cream.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, then the other thing you want to do is you just want to provide a lot of reassurance that you are just interested and curious about what they're thinking and how they're feeling about whatever the topic is that you're wanting you know, to talk with them about it. And a big pet peeve of mine is I think there's so much advice out there about how to talk to children about difficult events. And I think that has us emphasizing the wrong thing. It's not what we say to kids during difficult events. It's how we listen and hear from them. And again, I'll just point out, we're often really surprised if we do a good job of listening to them. What they're worried about may not be what we think they are worried about, especially younger children who developmentally are very egocentric. They should be. And they're much less concerned about what is happening in other places. They're much more concerned about what does this mean for me, my immediate life, safety, well-being, family here, the immediacy. And, you know, and we don't know that until we sort of, you know, approach with an open mind and just ask questions.
So if a father turning to a son or a daughter and saying, You can't ignore me. You can't just sit at the computer and ignore me. When Tati, Daddy speaks to you, you have to answer. So if I say that to my child, and you're the child, what is the child processing? And why is that wrong? And how can I substitute that phrase?
Well, the child is starting to get dysregulated, and there's different forms of dysregulation. There's escalating. You'll have some children will tell you, I'm not ignoring you. I don't want to talk to you right now. And they may yell at you. They may say something that you know, is particularly offensive. But another child may continue ignoring. But honestly, you know, their brain may have completely dissociated and they're not focused anymore. And so, you know, if what was the first thing you said that child said back to you?
No, the child just doesn't add this. You get more angry. You're going to get this. You're going to do that. You can't ignore. When I ask you a question, you got to answer.
My approach would be quite the opposite, which is the reassurance that actually you can ignore if this is a bad time for us to talk. So it seems like maybe this is a bad time, or you're not feeling ready, or there's something about this that isn't going so well. We don't have to talk right now. Okay. That's a form of reassurance. We don't have to talk right now. I'd like to talk at some point, so maybe later we can find a good time to talk. And that's another important point, is you can actually collaborate around when you should talk, where you should talk, and how you should talk before you even talk. So what does that look like? Okay, well, then just skip that interaction that just happened. Come back to them later when they're eating their ice cream.
I guess it takes work from a parent not to take it personal and become defensive. Like, you're ignoring me. Like, it's almost like I need you, my kid, to be my therapist and reassure me that I'm a respectable person. I think that's something we can all fall into very easily.
Absolutely. And look, we feel very disrespected very easily, right? and there is nothing like disrespect or feeling like our authority has been challenged to have us reach for power and control again.
Right.
Because where that conversation usually goes is, you're ignoring me. Stop ignoring me.
Right.
If you don't...
You're ignoring me. It's about me.
And if you don't stop and pay attention to me, here's what's going to happen to you, because let me remind you, I am the one who holds the power here. And emphasizing a power differential, it ironically further dysregulates kids. Mm. Okay. So, you know, reaching for that power.
You mean because they feel less safe? Because they feel less safe?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And again, I just want to emphasize that can take different forms, because sometimes people think, oh, no, when I get very stern and angry with my child, you know, I can sit, they calm down and they stay focused. That is what we call dissociative compliance. That is a child in their brain thinking, danger, danger. What can I do to get this over with as quickly as possible? Because this is uncomfortable. And generally what that looks like is a child just sort of playing along with whatever they think we want to hear in that moment, or what they want us to do, so that they can get past this as quickly as possible.
So it's really the inner work of the parent to always tune into where the child is and make that adjustment. Yes.
And again, you know, if even the most attuned parent, we're going to be wrong in terms of where a child is at often. So this is why being curious and asking questions. Well, we don't have to talk right now. It's okay. You can ignore me right now. But can you just quickly tell me why you're not responding? And then we can leave it. But it'll just help me to know for the future. And, you know, you'll be surprised what comes out of a kid's mouth, right? It might be because I'm in the middle of something, as simple as that. But it might be because I think you're mad at me, or because I know I must have done something wrong. And the nice thing is, if you hear anything from a child, anything, it provides you an opportunity to sort of operationalize empathy. Because anything a child says to you is something you can reflect back to them. Leave me alone. Okay, sounds like you want me to leave you alone. And you know what? I'm not going to force this right now. Okay. Or I'm in the middle of something. Oh, all right. So you're right in the middle of something right now. I mean, this is not rocket science, right? I'm just reflecting back what a child has said. But that alone is very regulating.
But sometimes parents are struggling because, let's say, the child hits them or says something really not nice, you know, obnoxious, and they feel it's their responsibility. You know, you don't hit your mommy. You don't say these words. And then they're stuck between Dr. Ablon, who says, understand their frustration or their experience, and, oh, so my child should now hit me? Like, could you answer
that? And let me be clear that I think it's fine to tell a child that they shouldn't hit you. I just, in my experience, 99% of the time, that child is already aware that they shouldn't hit their parent, and yet they're still hitting their parent. Now, I think it's absolutely fine, of course, to let them know that they shouldn't do that. And let me also be clear that I am not someone who says you should never use a consequence, in parenting. I just always tell people, be smart about what consequences accomplish and what they don't accomplish. And they are good at reminding children of what to do or not to do. And they're good at motivating children, because they don't want to receive that consequence again, to behave better in the future. But they don't teach skills. And if a child...
Give me this scenario. This child is saying very derogatory things, or actually physically hitting a father or a mother, even if it's light. But the point is, so could you, act out the appropriate behavior?
What I would need to know a little bit more about is, what is the situation that is giving rise to that in the first place? Because, by the way, kids don't start swearing, screaming, hitting for no reason out of the blue. People say sometimes they think that's the case. There is always a trigger, always an antecedent. There's always something your child is
having. Right. So a father tells me, right, he goes to pick up his child from school. It's not far. One day he doesn't come with the car. He decides, let's walk, a little exercise. It's a nice weather. The boy loses it. The boy loses it. He sits down on the ground, throws a tantrum, hitting the father because he didn't come with his car. He's going to walk. Yeah. They're going to walk back home. The father thought it's going to be an amazing experience. It's a disaster.
This is why I was smiling, because I could think that this would be something I would do. What a great idea. We'll take a walk, beautiful day together.
We'll take a hike. We'll contemplate the beauty of nature. We'll talk about the bee dance.
And let's be clear that this is a great example of, we don't yet know why this idea of walking, went over so poorly with this particular child. And there's myriad reasons that could be the case. And the sort of the bedrock of my work is, try to be curious, not furious. Now, I will say this to you. This, in the heat of the moment there, it's much harder to do this kind of problem solving. And if this is the only time something like this is ever going to happen with that child, you'll do the best in the moment. Something is just passing. The reality is, this is probably an issue that has happened before and will recur. And so the worst time to problem solve is when they're sitting there on the curb. Doing that another time when the kid's in a better space proactively, much better. But let's go back to the scenario, because you've got the child. Let's say they've sworn a bunch or whatever and yelled, and they're now parked on the curb and sort of refusing to move, right? No surprise, what am I going to suggest? Start with empathy, okay? And what does empathy look like? Wow, okay, I guess I thought it would be a good idea for us to take walk back. I thought that was a good idea. Looks like it was a really bad idea in your mind. Okay, don't worry. I'm not going to force you to walk back. And by the way, when people say, wait a second, why would you say that to a kid? I say that to a kid because I think to myself, I don't know how I'm going to force this child to walk back in the first place. It's not a big leap to say that. But what I do is I take imposition of will off the table. That is regulating. I'm not going to force you. It sounds like this was a really bad idea. Can you fill me in about why it's a bad idea? Don't worry, I'm not going to force you. I want to understand. Hmm. And then what could you hear? You could hear everything from something very practical. It's going to take us longer to get home, and I wanted to do X, Y, Z once I got home. It could be something they're going to have a hard time telling you, which is that they actually would like to be seen with their father as little as possible around their peers. And hopping in the car and getting out of there is going to be a lot quicker than they might be spied by some of their friends. Who knows? And by the way, it could be something the child isn't even able to articulate, because a whole bunch of kids who struggle to manage their behavior, one of their underlying skills that they have a hard time with is what we call cognitive flexibility, fancy word for flexible thinking. And what that means is, when everything goes according to plan, rules, routine in the world, life is great. But if you throw a change, something new, ambiguous, uncertain, they weren't expecting, unpredictability, they have a very hard time with it. Okay. Now, that, by the way, for people listening here, that's very typical for young children. You know, developmentally, this is a skill that you build. But you can have a much older child who really struggles in that skill domain. And by the way, if they struggle enough along with some other skills, maybe they would have a diagnosis on the autism spectrum. But regardless of whether it's a minor or age appropriate challenge or a more significant clinical challenge, that may be what's interfering, is that you just they have a black and white brain, and they were thinking black and you threw white at them.
Right.
They can't compute. Okay. Now, I think, Rabbi, what people are going to say is, okay, great. Let's say you were able to calm the child down. Let's say they told you, maybe it's as simple as, I don't feel like walking. I'm tired. Let's do it that way. Okay. So you get their concern on the table. They've calmed down a little bit through your empathy. What do you do now? And what we say to people is, well, you express your perspective or your concern, which is, okay, well, you know, I guess I thought it might be fun, nice to walk together outside, but that's just what I thought. Okay. What you think is you're tired and you just want to get home. What I was thinking is this might be fun for us to walk. So we were thinking about this a little bit differently. Okay. And the reason I'm doing this with my hands, folks, is this is how I always illustrate whether you're really collaborating with a child. Because if you only have, you know, your concern on the table, I thought it would be nice, you are headed right towards imposing your parental will. If you only have their concern on the table, which is, I didn't want to walk, I'm tired, I just want to get home, you're headed just to addressing their concern. True collaboration is, there's two sets of concerns here, okay? Which leads to the final, what I call, ingredient of this. The first ingredient being hearing out the child, the second being expressing your concern or perspective, the third being, let's collaborate. And what does that look like? So what do you think we can do now? Because you just want to get home and you're tired and you don't feel like walking, and I hear you, okay? And by the way, let me just point out to people, you could be thinking at that time, what do you mean you're tired? Do you have any idea what tired is? I'll tell you what tired is, okay? You know, school is not nearly as tiring as, do you want to hear what your dad did today? That's not empathy. And empathy is not agreeing or disagreeing. It is simply understanding. The child is saying they are tired. They don't feel like walking. Okay. And you had that idea you thought was good. So what do you think we can do now? Since you're tired and don't feel like walking, I had this idea, but it didn't sound like a great idea to you. What do you think we can do at this point? And you're inviting the child and you're giving them first crack at solutions, which is not only practice in problem solving, but it is giving them ownership, autonomy, buy-in, so that they're going to be invested in whatever solution we try to fashion.
But you elicited a response from the child. What if you didn't even get there? It's throwing a tantrum, screaming, hollering, crying.
Right. Well, so first of all, if they don't respond, you have another tool at your disposal. Again, it's not rocket science, but it's called educated guessing, right? I mean, there's only so many reasons in all likelihood the child didn't want to walk. So what would I do if they were just quiet? I would say, okay, well, do you mind if I take a guess here? Is it just that you're tired and don't feel like it? Is it you wanted to get home quick for some reason? Is it that this was just a surprise you weren't expecting? Or is it something else that you know of, but I haven't guessed yet? And it's like playing 20 questions, okay? With most kids, you won't get 20. But the other thing, the worst case scenario is, let's say they're too upset. They're too dysregulated to access this part of their brain to fill you in. Well, you know, you could decide, I'm in crisis management mode here. What I'm going to do is say, okay, you know what? Sounds like I made a mistake and would have been good for us to talk this through ahead of time. You're not feeling so good about this. Let's just figure out how we get home, you know, as quickly as possible without walking. Okay. If that's an option.
Dr. Ablon, can I just chime in?
Please.
Everything you're saying applies to everyday life. Is there anything different that during these uncertain times, you know, I brought it up in a different webinar that we did that a couple of weeks ago, there was an article that there were helicopters over Brooklyn, New York during the end of school to sort of protect the kids and make sure they were safe. So obviously there's a lot of elements of uncertainty and, you know, safety concerns, et cetera. Is there anything else or anything different or any additional thoughts, ideas that we might give to our children during these specifically dysregulating times?
Yes. And thank you for grounding us in the current context that gives rise for this webinar in particular right now. I think the most important thing to for us all to realize here is in times of heightened stress, what happens is we all lose access to skills that we had before and were able to apply. So what this means is that you're going to see children who weren't throwing tantrums, weren't having difficulty. You're going to see children who were having difficulty have much more difficulty because, you know, all of our skills are really dependent on the context we're in and the resulting state that our brain is in. And if we are in a context that is very stressful and anxiety ridden and scary, what it means is that our brains are in more of a state of heightened arousal, an activated sort of response. And in a state of heightened arousal, we have less access to all those skills. So, for example, you could have a child who has no cognitive flexibility issues, really. They're pretty flexible for their age. And something like that, this example we were just sharing, would never have thrown them during ordinary times. But during these times, as simple as I thought we would walk home when they were expecting to get picked up, that could tap into inflexibility that's there that wasn't before. And by the way, a good reason inflexibility might pop up in a way that it wasn't before is a sense of control. You know, in times that are frightening and outside of one's control, all of us, we seek control, understandably. Kids who have been traumatized, not just kids, people who have been traumatized, subject to chronic toxic stress in their lives, seek control. So, you know, you're going to see chances or opportunities, situations arise where there's going to be much more of a control struggle than you've ever had before because the child is searching for some control in their lives. So, in other words, everything we've been talking about is even more important. And I would say to us parents during these times, give more leeway to your child and yourself to not have to solve the problem. And really to not, let me be clear, not give in, but to make a strategic decision to say, you know what? This is a stressful time. We don't have to walk home right now. It seems like something has touched this off and kids do well if they can. They're doing the best they can. You know what? This is not a battle I need to fight here. We're going to come up with a different backup plan to get home quick in a car. And we're just going to sidestep that one for now because you're going to have more issues to contend with currently.
You mentioned something very powerful that, you know, children have that egocentricity, and you said, and it should be that way. I think sometimes it's hard for us because the word ego can be a really bad word, you know, egocentric, narcissistic, self-indulgent, selfish, etc. Could you clarify how allowing the child to be egocentric, maybe there's a different word for it, but is really the healthy thing for the development of that child? Like, yeah, he's worried about himself or herself, not about the world, and it's supposed to be that
developmentally appropriate, right? In terms of children's development, even their moral development, they should be most concerned about themselves earlier in life. And so, you know, trying to buck that developmental trend is not going to go well. But the
because it basically destroy their self-esteem, self-love.
Yeah, but I also want to point out that even in that discussion that we were sort of role-playing there, you know, when you are really present empathizing and trying to understand your child's perspective, it's not that you are reinforcing an egocentric nature for them, because what you're showing them is here's what empathy looks like. Mm. Okay. Here's, I'm modeling empathy for you.
They'll learn to do it with others.
Well, you actually are asking them to do it with you, because the moment you share, okay, well, and here's what I was thinking, is you're saying, wow, you know what, I just asked you to practice.
So you're actually teaching them much more kindness and selflessness.
You got it.
So when you use the word egocentric, what you really mean is create the safety for the child to be able to feel secure and soothed and safe. So now they can actually give and
you're modeling that. You are modeling it, and then you're asking them to practice it. Now, I'm also aware, by the way, that there's some questions in the Q&A here. Should we take some of those here?
We'll get the.
I wanted to, like, just that example that you were giving. I was like sitting through it and watching what you were doing with your hands. I felt like that was, on one hand, we were also practicing as a parent. This was the scale over here. And that was what you were saying at the beginning. A parent has to make sure they're grounded and what, right? And so we are practicing, and we're also teaching our kids to practice. So I was waiting for you to sort of like hear out the skill and then apply it to what's happening these days. So for example, I'm trying to like bring it back to what's going on. How much do I share with my kids? What do I not say to my kids? How do I make them feel safe? Where does that skill come in when I'm hearing what you're saying about the kid is going to have a tantrum, but the kids are afraid. They're hearing things in school. They're not hearing, like, how do we apply this to our everyday life currently when I feel fear? Or Rabbi, you were talking at the beginning about the anger, and there's so much injustice happening right now. Our anger is consistent. How do I stop the anger while I'm in anger and still apply this to them?
Well, I think one of the important things here that we've been discussing is you need to be careful not to project necessarily your anger and your fear onto your child. You need to start by trying to figure out where they are at. Now, and you mentioned, you know, they're seeing things, they're hearing things. One of the first places to start is to ask them what they've seen and what they've heard and what they know, and try to unpack what their experience so far has been so that you know where to start. And this is what I was saying before, like the idea of that, you know, for instance, I could tell you what you should say to your child right now. Frankly, I have absolutely no idea what you should say to your child, because I don't know what your child is thinking and feeling, and I don't know what they've experienced and been exposed to. And I need to hear that first. Right. So what does that look like? It looks like picking the right time, the right place, as we discussed earlier, to start a conversation where you're going into detective mode. And it might start as neutrally as, you know, there's been a lot of things going on in the world that, you know, I have been very worried about and upset, a lot of scary things.
Can I pause for 1 second? Because as you're saying it, I'm thinking to myself, what if the child didn't express to me? Am I putting something on them when I ask that? Because what if they didn't even tell me? I just know.
Well, this is what I was saying before, though. If you are telling me that you are feeling intense anger and fear, there is no way your child is not aware of those feelings in you. There is no way. So, and now again, I don't want to project, because I'm going to go into information gathering mode quickly, but it might be, you know, you probably been able to tell that mom has been very upset and worried lately, and there's a lot of important and scary things going on, and I wanted to talk to you about them because I don't even know, you know, how much you know and what you have seen and what you have heard, and I'd like to understand. And that's the stance of what I call this first ingredient of a discussion like this, entering into empathy, is I'd like to understand. And you're starting to ask a bunch of questions. As the rabbi said, what if your child says nothing back? You can do some educated guesses. Okay. If they say anything to you, you have an opportunity to reflect that to them. And I want to respond in this context to Ruth's question she typed in, just because it's a quick one here. She said, when I reflect back to my children, they yell at me, stop repeating what I said. If your child is saying that, you don't have to repeat back exactly what they said. What you can say is, okay, so what I'm hearing from you is, or have I got this right? It can be in any words you want, and say it a little different. In fact, I encourage us as parents to not directly repeat back what a child says, because that is annoying to them often, just parroting them, but to say it in your own words. And that's an opportunity for them to be able to tell oh, wow, they are really hearing it, because they're sending it back to me suggesting they've thought about it and this is their, you know, their interpretation of it. But basically, going back to this conversation, as soon as you kick it off, it's questions, it's guesses, it's reflecting things you've heard, and it's trying to reassure them, I really just want to understand what's going on, what your experience is, what you've heard, what you think, what you feel. Is that helpful?
I think so. And I think there was one question somebody is just asking. They read about a mother who wanted her kid to understand what's going on in the world. So she took them to one of these rallies or to one of these places, and she showed them the Shabbos table set up, right? The table that's set for Sabbath with all the names of the kids who were kidnapped. And she wanted her kid to feel empathy to what's going on. So she took him there, and they walked from one chair to the next and read the name of this kid and this child and that child and that child. And the kid fell apart. He was 7 years old, and he fell on the ground, and he's crying and crying. And she's saying, this is what I did. And she's showing how beautiful it is that her child understands, is finally understanding what's happening. And then this mother's saying, I feel so guilty because I don't say a word to my kid. Like, where's the balance? Yes. I'm not telling my kid that there's even a war. Am I allowed to just completely hold back these days? And other mothers are taking their kids out there to show them these tables and the stuffed animals.
I mean, I don't know the situation, but if I may say something, I really don't understand why there's a need to take young children and deprive them from their childhood when it's not necessary. Why not bring our children together to the table and say, our brothers and sisters in Israel are going through a challenging time, and we're going to pray together, we're going to sing together, we're going to send love together to them, we're going to do a mitzvah together, we're going to give charity for them, we're going to recite psalms together. Let's use it as an opportunity to highlight those emotions and those that sense of unity that brings positivity to the world. We're Jews. We know the power of faith, of a mitzvah, of prayer, of spiritual connection. That's why we're here thousands of years later. We're here because of these gifts. That's what I want to give my child. I'm not understanding why take a 7-year-old kid or a 6-year-old kid or an 8-year-old kid and subject them to the knowledge of atrocities. Right? That are difficult for us. I have a hard time sleeping, and I'm 51 years old. I don't see the benefit of it.
Right. And I guess I would just so I agree entirely. And I would add, you know, what I described before: kids do well if they can. We need to apply it to ourselves as well, which is to say, parents do well if they can. Which is, I am positive that parent had a really, really good rationale for why this was a good idea. Now, developmentally, it sounds like it was too much for that child. And there were probably better ways to address the parent's concern about helping their child understand what's going on in the world and to have empathy. There were better ways developmentally to do that, but I want to recognize the parent's instinct and concern was a good one, maybe just not the solution. And, you know, it really does matter a kid's age and developmental level, because at a different age and with a different child, that might be a very powerful, appropriate thing to do. But this, to me, all gets back to, let's not impose solutions or, frankly, interpretations, feelings, emotions, responses onto our children. You can't make someone feel something. What you need to do is you need to start with where they're at. So, for instance, you know, I would have loved to have that parent have a conversation with their child, understanding where their child is at, what they're hearing, what they're knowing, things like this, and raising the concern of it. I think it would be helpful for you to have a sense of what's going on for some of the children. What do you think that could look like? And you could talk about it together, but not just sort of come up with a solution like that. And I really appreciate you raising and being honest about, you know, here people are taking, going to lengths like that. And I feel like I haven't even mentioned that there's a war going on. And look, we do need to find a middle ground. Okay. And where that middle ground is going to depend on your child, where they're at developmentally, what their skills are, and frankly, what they feel like they are ready for, can tolerate, et cetera. They need to be co-creators of the solution there. I would suggest in your case, Yeah. Your child is how old again? Did you say seven?
Yeah.
So, you know, again, they're understanding your emotions. And frankly, knowing that and feeling that your mom, your dad is very worried, very scared, very concerned, very mad, angry, and not knowing why that is much more upsetting than hearing some about what's going on, believe it or not. And again, I'll go back to the egocentrism of young children, because what young children often assume is it's about me. I must be doing something that is causing my mom to feel so angry, scared, etc. So it's often very reassuring for a child. Now, this is where we need to control our own emotions, because a child may feel relief to hear, oh, this is about a war going on, not about something in my own family right here. Our adult response might be, this is not relieving. That's not the response I was looking for for you. And this is where we can't project our own reactions. And we need to realize that it's okay developmentally for a child to feel that way. So we can't attribute emotion. We want to try to understand where the child's coming from.
Well,
if I can add also, I grew up as a child at the feet of the great Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he was such a powerful proponent of bringing children together, especially during difficult times for the Jewish people, and having them say verses of Torah together, and verses of hope and healing and love and giving charity together and singing and encouraging their spirit and praying together. And his point was, first of all, it creates safety for the children. It shows them that we're in this together. And the most powerful thing is, it teaches them the spiritual connectedness of the universe. Our words, our attitudes, our love, our connection to God, to our souls, it brings love into the world. It brings power and empowerment and strength to the Jewish people. This is how we actually help our brothers and sisters. We want to help our brothers and sisters more than anything else. And yeah. Children, from a Jewish perspective, are the the link between heaven and earth, the innocence of children and the purity of children. You know, in the times of Purim, again, Iran, Persia, Haman wanted to annihilate all the Jews, and Mordechai gathered 22,000 children, not to frighten them and scare the living daylights out of them, but actually they learned Torah together, 22. And the Talmud says that that was the spiritual salvation of the Jewish people. So I think, you know, I want my children to know who they are, to know what it means to be a Jew at this time. But to give my child the empowerment of how he or she and all of us can actually do something in a very real, deep, authentic way to bring more light to our brothers and sisters and to innocent people the world over.
Right. I have another question that's coming up. I'm sure this is coming up to so many of our people, because we are Jews and we have all the laws. And I don't know, Rabbi, I'm going to direct it to you first, because what's if Kabe de Sabicha Vesimecha? I'm going to let you translate it. But when Dr. Ablon's saying over here,
he knows it. It's the fourth commandment of the Ten Commandments. Trust me, right? Dr. Ablon heard about it. respect your father and mother. So what's the question?
So the question is, when we're starting here at the beginning and we're saying, like,
oh,
you know, I have to be empathic to my child. I want him to do something now. And we're going to have, I mean, we've had so many of these questions come out on our previous ones. Where I'm a parent. What do you mean? They're supposed to respect me. That's how it is. That's our morals. We teach them that we're a parent. Like, what do you mean? I have to back off?
Like, right. It's a great question. Let me tell you how I see it. I'm sure there's much more to this. I'm just going to tell you how I see it. And that is as follows. Let's think about adults, okay? Tova, I know I'm not your father, I'm not your mother, but how would you respect me or any person more if you feel that I understand you and I care for you and I get you and I really want to be here for you, or you just feel that I'm a clueless individual who has absolutely no understanding of your life, even if I mean well and I'm not a bad person, when would you respect me more? I'm not even talking about love. I'm talking about respect. I think... Right. What Dr. Ablon is telling us, and I think it's a very powerful idea. I don't see that at all as contradicting respect. If I want my child to really respect me, not say that he respects me because he's afraid of me losing myself and going crazy and hollering in the house, but really respect me, The more a father and mother are tuned in to the soul and the emotions and the needs of their children and show them, we're here for you. We are a presence of authority and compassion and empathy. But authority doesn't mean I can crush you. Authority means I'm going to take the responsibility and I'm going to display the power and the presence of mind to be here for you. I think mm-hmm. that probably elicits the profoundest respect. Ultimately, when that child is 40 or 50, 60, 70 years old, they will still be respecting father and mother. And I think also there are times respecting father and mother is also about actions, which means how do you speak to your father? How do you talk to your mother? How do you communicate to them, even if you're disagreeing? And I think the more children feel understood and respected, the more they will actually feel inspired and enthusiastic about showing that respect to their parents, even if there may sometimes be a disagreement, but they'll still know what respect means. I think it actually helps the behavior of respect, even on an external level, because if I really respect somebody inside, so then my behavior of respect in terms of words and actions will probably be elevated to a much more authentic and profound degree. That's how I feel about it.
Rabbi Wywy, I'm sure you're familiar with this Rashi, but there's a pasuk Yadaiti Levana Sheyitzavas. Yeah. Rashi writes there Ki Yadaiti. He says Lashon Chiba Shehamachabev Es Benoi Shehamachabev Es Adam Akarve Etzlei VeYodei UMakirei.
Yeah. I want Dr. Abel to understand what you said.
Yes,
there's
ahead.
A verse in Genesis where God explains why he chose Abraham as the father of the Jewish people and ultimately all the Abraham Rekfethes. And he says the language is because I know him. So Rashi, one of the great commentators, said it's a language of love because When you really cherish somebody and love them and you're actually knowing them, it's about knowing them. So I think, right, that's what you mean to bring out?
Yeah.
There's a beautiful comment here that I don't know because I don't know all the Makoros and everything, but somebody over here writes, Yaakov Avinu called his children my brothers. Right? He referred to his children as like later on.
Somebody asks a question, why is there resistance to these ideas of Dr. Ablon in the religious community? I don't think it's real resistance. I think just people are scared that we don't want to raise obnoxious, rude, self-centered, immoral, promiscuous, narcissistic kids. And if I follow this advice, my kids are going to become rotten potatoes and rotten tomatoes, do whatever they want, scream, curse, hit. When they're teens, who know what are going to do? If I can rule with discipline and authority and decisive morality and not all this understanding, empathy. Yeah, you could scream at your father, empathy. They're going to grow up to be horrible people, horrible Jews. I think that's what people are afraid of. And I get it. But I think it's because we're not really worked out. We're just coming from a place of fear. And we ourselves are dysregulated. And maybe it happened to us as kids. So we think that's what we have to communicate to the next generation. I don't find this advice and this perspective as trying to raise children who are spoiled and bratty and rotten. I think it's the exact opposite. I think it's about bringing out the deepest goodness of children, believing in them, believing what Torah teaches us, that every person has a divine, infinite soul, and organically they are the most beautiful, beautiful people. Yeah, we have a Yetzirah. We can have negative inclinations that block our beauty, and our job is to remove that and help kids and ourselves make those choices. Am I going to live in a space of love and serenity and light, or am I going to live in a space of misery and resentment and negativity and lack of forgiveness? And the more we help people see their light, the more they can choose between their light and their darkness. That's what it's about. It's about educating children from within. It's about creating people who will really identify with the spiritual values in the deepest way. It's not about forcing it. one day every child becomes independent. You know, today it's already happening at a very young age. Right? You used to become independent, I don't know, at 20, 30 today already. You know, if your kid is not independent at 9, it's a miracle. 13, 14, oh my God, they're going on 90. So I think this is really about education, where you're inculcating empowerment into them, that they ultimately become agent. They have agency and they can identify what's happening inside of them by us modeling that type of relationship. I mean, that's how I'm seeing it. That's how I'm seeing it. I feel resistance to this is something that's coming from my own fear or my own insecurity. The fact that I'm not worked out. I'm not working on myself. And education, as Dr. Ablan said, real education is about educating yourself. Much more than your child, right?
I mean, if I could just add, I mean, I think, look, we need to remember that discipline, the word discipline actually really means to teach. And, you know, I think there's a misconception also that this type of parenting is somehow permissive parenting and sort of taking lackadaisical, taking the easy, route. Which it is not at all. What we're talking about today is very hard work. It is anything but
right. It's harder. It's harder work.
It's much harder work.
Exactly. And look,
because we're also working on ourselves.
Yeah, and I think the comments about respect before. Look, if we want to teach children to respect their elders, people in position of authority, other humans. We have to teach them how to do that. And in essence, what I think we're trying to describe today is how to respect a child, respect their emotions, their thoughts, their feelings, where they're at. And, what I found is when you listen really hard to anyone, they're much more likely to be receptive to listening to your teachings as well.
I just want to read out a comment here. We'll give a shout out to Mar Shavis. One of your star students, Dr. Ablan, she writes, as a from Orthodox Jew who has been trained directly by Dr. Ablan and has been using this model both professionally and personally for many years, I'd like to share that his model works in remarkable ways and only strengthens our Masorah and Chinuch principles, which means our tradition. So thank you, Tamar, for that. I do think we have a live question.
Can I just interject that thank you for those comments, Tamar. And Tamar is a true expert in this work. And so she is an incredible resource to people in this community who are really wanting to be able to take some of these concepts and these ideas and really make them things that can come alive within your community and within your faith. So I recommend Tamar Shames is an incredible resource for the
community. Tamar, it's so nice to have you on. And, I know you spoke to the doctor about it, and we are hopefully going to be rolling out something with Tamar for our alumni and for parents to, I know we've had some conversation about it, and we're moving in that direction. We've spoken a lot about it already. Wonderful. So it's nice to see you, Tamar.
I think somebody asked you a very powerful question. I want to get, if we can get Dr. Ablan's feedback. In Judaism, there's a teaching that anger is not a good thing. So this person is asking, if maybe when we talk about anger, and you spoke earlier about anger, maybe a deeper and more authentic word would be pain. In other words, when I'm angry, there's injustice. I'm hearing something that wreaks such injustice and maybe cruelty and barbarism. I'm in pain. That pain means you're a human being. You have a good heart. You have a conscience, for heaven's sake. I don't want to get rid of that pain. If I get rid of that pain, it means I lost my soul. I think the distinction between pain and anger is a form of helplessness. I'm just angry. I'm just angry. Okay, so what now? So I'm going to break my windows. I'm going to punch you in the nose. If we can identify it as pain, pain could be a motivator. So what can I do right now? What can I do right now to bring more love into my life, to bring more light into the world? I think that maybe is a powerful distinction. Judaism is against anger, not because it doesn't want you to feel emotions, but it wants you to be able to direct that emotion into productivity, into healing, rather than anger is just, I'm a helpless person who's just angry at the world and all the sick people that live in the world. Okay, so now what?
And this
I should eat, so now I'm going to go eat.
And this is one of the reasons I referenced my colleague's work, Dr. Mark Brackett, before, who, you know, one of the things he teaches is really trying to help people develop a language of emotion and to be more granular, because we often describe our emotions in these categories. I'm angry. I'm happy. I'm sad. I'm anxious. I mean, anxious is a great example. That word is used so much now, but it doesn't really tell us what we're actually feeling. We need to be much more granular in terms of understanding our own emotions. And so, I think folks might find his work particularly helpful. He actually even has an app that helps you take an emotion and really drill down to be more specific. What am I actually really feeling here?
What's that app called?
What's that?
You know what that app is called?
I think it's called the Mood Meter, because that's the tool that they use. Mood Meter. But Mark Brackett is his name. He's at the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence. His book is Permission to Feel, but it's this Mood Meter that basically sort of divides our emotions into four quadrants to start. And it basically starts by saying, what's the degree of pleasantness or unpleasantness you're feeling? And sort of the arousal level, is it sort of a high or a low arousal? And then you go from there into these four quadrants and you drill down further. It really helps us to get much more sophisticated in our emotional awareness and our language when communicating with one another as well.
Right.
There's a first question here. Is somebody coming on live? Is somebody asking a nice question?
Tzvi, I see your hand is raised. I did give you permission to talk. We'll give you a moment. Maybe it was a mistake. And that's okay. But Rabbi Weiwei, there's a question here from, you want to read somebody
ZC, else? ZC? I wanted to read ZC.
Yes, so go ahead, read question. It. Yeah, go ahead.
I have a 6-year-old daughter. I feel like I hold my breath when I hear the door opening when she's coming home from school, because from the moment she walks in, she's already complaining. She wants to go to her friend. The friend has to come to the house. It makes me so miserable. She comes home like that without even giving me a chance. It's like she didn't want to come home in the first place. It's like a curse to come home. Is there a way that I can make my daughter's homecoming from school be more pleasant? She also puts up a fuss about everything I tell her. She also gets into her siblings. She gets into fights with her siblings and that have nothing to do with her. The siblings are fighting. It's almost as if she makes sure that she's loud enough to be heard. What can I do? 6-year-old girl. A mother is lamenting.
Well, this is a good example of, there may be a lot more sort of general dysregulation going on for this particular child at this time, because you're seeing it cut across different situations. But my advice would be to say, I mentioned earlier that these kinds of difficulties tend to be predictable, that they don't come up out of the blue for no apparent reason. And it sounds like you're describing this the moment she comes home from school. It sounds like it's very predictable that when she walks in, she's upset and wants to have a friend over, go to a friend's, et cetera. That's the problem you want to try to solve, and don't try to solve it when she walks in the door from school. Catch her at a moment where she's regulated, calm, as we said before, and start with curiosity. And I would recommend you say something like this. I've noticed when you come home, you seem really eager to have a friend over or go to a friend's. And I want to try to help understand so we can, do something that'll work for both of us. Can you fill me in? How come? And this is where thank you for being honest about, what you're worried about is that it's like she feels miserable when she comes home or she doesn't want to be at home. And I wouldn't jump to those conclusions just yet. We need to take the time to unpack it from your daughter's perspective. Use those questions, take guesses if need be. But I would say if you have to take a guess, don't jump to, is it that you don't want to be home and you don't like being home? Don't jump there. I would start with other educated guesses, like, do you feel like you're not having enough time to be around your friends? Is there something about being with your friends that feels much better than for right now being, at home without friends? I would use those kinds of questions. And once you understand her concern, then you'll raise any concern you have and invite her to problem solve what this could look like. Because I don't know. When you say, is there a way I can make my daughter's homecoming from school more pleasant? I'm sure there is. But I don't know what that looks like now until we understand more of her perspective or more of her point of view here.
Zvi is here. Zvi,
yes.
do you want to ask a question? Go ahead.
You can hear me?
Yeah.
I can hear you.
Okay, great. It's more of a plug. I just want to say that the Fresh Start program helped me work on myself and identify traumas and deal with them. And I saw that, you know, my children respect me more because I did that alone. And
wow.
You know, there's a way to go with many things, not an overnight change, but I do have to give a lot of credit to the Fresh Start program.
I won't forget your call to me when you called in and we spoke about who should come first, the parent or the child. And Zvi was an amazing example. We wanted to send a child and we spoke about the the power that a parent has. So Zvi, thank you for that.
And I also think, you know, to highlight one of the words of Dr. Ablon earlier, many of us were trained, you know, from in a very, very young age that education is about words and actions. And I think what we're learning so much more, words and actions are very important, but real education is about pnimius. It's about who I am. It's about how I show up emotionally. And the more, if I'm bedecked, if I'm encompassed and enveloped in my own trauma, in my own anger, in my own pain and resentment that I have never dealt with, how can I show up for anybody else? I'm just trying to survive. It's like you're choking me 24/7, right? And you say, oh, show up for your children. I'm just trying to breathe. Get your hands off my neck. And that's what trauma looks like. Trauma chokes us. It chokes us to death. We're just trying to survive. Sometimes from age 3, especially people who have been, you know, abused. It's not even their fault. It's not nobody's fault. And the more, you know, I can clear it up, we can clear it up and we can go into our own love, you know, with self-love. Then I can really show up. I can show up for my wife. I can show up for my children. And the emotional presence surpasses everything. I mean, that's the key to everything. Your child feels your presence at dinner table, sitting and playing a game, schmoozing, going out. That presence, I think, is the most healing factor. And the words and actions then flow from that.
I do want to be respectful of Dr. Ablon's time, so perhaps we can move into wrap up. Dr. Ablon, any other?
Sure.
Well, fine. There was quickly a question of Joseph at the bottom, right before, because you're moving into wrap up.
You know what? Malka wanted to ask a live question on behalf of teachers, so let's just do that.
Okay.
Let me allow you. Malka, you are now allowed to talk. You just have to unmute yourself. There you go.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So I'm doing some consulting with teachers in schools, and I had a long conversation with a teacher yesterday who was saying that she's struggling because students feel so entitled. She gave like a small example, a longer example. One, the smaller example was in the lunchroom, if she's trying to make room for a particular student or trying to shuffle things around for the sake of a student, and she asks, you know, okay, can you please move over? And the students are like, no, like, we don't want to move over. That's like a small question. A bigger question is that she had done an activity out, like during the school day, but outside of school at one of the kids. The grandparents have a Chabad house. They did like a Fabringen. And the kids planned. She had like groups of kids plan different aspects of the activity, and they got into loggerheads over some of the aspects of the planning where, you know, the teacher wanted it to be, you know, reflective of the way it should be, you know, according to the school, according to the standards and hashkafa of the school. And the students had their own idea, and they felt very intruded upon when the teacher tried to modify at all what they wanted to do. They, you know, she initiated it, obviously, as the teacher, and they're like, it's our program. You don't get to say anything. You didn't get to, you know, you don't have an opinion. And so she would like to do another out of school activity. She's really a very kind and caring, empathetic teacher, but she's just like, that was just, it turned into such a big deal that, you know, she's just genuinely wanting some direction of how do you manage kids who feel so entitled to do what they want when they want.
Thank you. Thank you, Malta. Go ahead.
And these are seventh graders.
Go ahead, Dr. Ablon.
Sure. And look, the first thing I would say is, you know, behavior that can look like entitlement. Again, this is an interpretation to assume that it's entitlement. And, you know, a bunch of things could give rise to it. You know, to go back to the one child who, you know, refuses to move over. Again, this could be as simple as this is a child who has very strong feelings about sitting in a particular place. Now, I'm not suggesting they should be allowed to sit there. No. But it may be, you know, this is a question of not just being entitled, but a kid who has a hard time sort of incorporating change into a solution. And I'm going to give the same sort of broken record advice when they don't want to move over. I would say, okay, you don't want to move over. How come? What's going on? Really quick. Okay. And then, you know, this is why this is not permissive, because then the second step is saying, and I want to make sure we make room for our friend here. Now, in terms of the whole group process that's gone on, my guess would be here that it sounds from the description like maybe there was a bit of a misunderstanding with the students feeling like this was their creation themselves. And, you know, like you said, the educator sounds like they want to approach this very thoughtfully. I would just suggest a proactive conversation before the next time around, saying that it's great that they have been so engaged and taken such ownership of this. It is important that this be collaborative, and that just doesn't mean collaborative with just the students, but collaborative with the teacher as well, because the teacher's perspective and concerns need to be represented as well. So we need to do this together. So let's think about how we are going to structure this process so that it is your creation and mine as well, because this is intended to be something that I have, you know, input into as well. And that's not imposing your will. That's saying this is going to be true collaboration here. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Ablon, for that. And I guess let's move into just some final thoughts, Dr. Rabbi Wiley, then we'll ask you to wrap it up.
Yeah, sure. So I hope, first of all, I hope this discussion has been helpful for folks. And I do want to note one of the other comments in the Q&A that indicated, you know, that look, in very dysregulating times like this, this is not just children whose skills can recede. It is ours as well. So, you know, you may find any one of us here that we have good flexibility and impulse control and things like that under normal circumstances. But right now, our skills are slipping back. And we may find interactions with our spouses, partners, coworkers, colleagues, et cetera, are more tense and fraught than they were before as well. And so what I would just encourage people to remember is what I said earlier, this is not just kids do well if they can, students do well if they can. This is parents do well if they can. This is husbands and wives do well if they can, colleagues do well if they can. You know, we're all doing the best we can right now to manage what the world is throwing at us with the skills we're able to bring in that moment. And I'll go right back to the beginning of where I started today, which is the best way to regulate anybody, not just your child or a student, but your spouse, the best way to regulate is to listen. Our words are really, really powerful. They can regulate or they can dysregulate. Empathy, words of exploring, words of compassion, words of interest, words of curiosity are going to be the most regulating pieces of interaction. And the last thing I'll share is we started talking trauma at the end. It sounds like people have had some really meaningful interactions with Fresh Start. I can recommend a colleague, Dr. Bruce Perry's work. He wrote a book of recently that is very popular these days, thanks to being written with Oprah Winfrey, called What Happened to You, a wonderful book on trauma and its impacts as well. So I suggest you check that out also, as you know, everyone here tries to understand their own experience and how that's affecting how we go about managing our relationships in the world. Because the last thing I'll say is, you know, the best protection we have in times of incredible stress is social connection. It is the most powerful buffer, our social connectedness. You know, people talk about the fight or flight instinct. The flock instinct is really what helps humans survive over time. And so I encourage you all to maximize all opportunities for coming together and connectedness. And I hope this has served usefully in that purpose as well. So I thank you all for having me join the community. And I really do hope that my involvement and participation has been additive and helpful.
Absolutely. Thank you. And Rabbi YY, before we go.
Yeah. First of all, thank you. Thank you, Fresh Start. And thank you, Dr. Ablin, for your incredibly meaningful and profound words and ideas, not just here, but in so many other forms and places that so many of us benefit from. You know, I do want to mention something. It was in 1977 that my own mentor and spiritual teacher, known as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he spoke about education. And he said that in previous generation, the model was that one of the primary tools of education is external reward or consequences, whether it's a candy or a lollipop, or in ancient times, Maimonides speaks about giving children nuts. That's in the 12th century, giving children peanuts. That was considered cotton candy at the time, God's candies, you know, nuts, before we got all the sugar and glucose. And he said, there comes a time in history where history consciousness evolves. And he says, today you see that children are much more motivated by truth and authenticity than external rewards and consequences. Well, he told a story about one of the great Hasidic spiritual masters who was 4 years old, and he came to his grandfather when he was reading Genesis, and he started to cry. And he said, why are you crying? He said, why did God appear to Abraham and he doesn't appear to me? And he said, this is what a child is. A child is someone who cares, who really, really wants to be connected to truth, to authenticity. And he said that we should realize that those are our children today. Our children today are people, young souls, who can be inspired and motivated by the truth itself, by goodness itself, by knowing, realizing that this is who they really are. They really want to connect. They really want to connect with themselves. They really want to connect with others. They really want to connect with their souls. I just thought that's a very, very powerful illustration about a lot of this work. I just want to say a second point, and that's in terms of the time we're living in. I think our children will remember forever how we acted, how we lived, how we breathed during this time. So with all of the challenges and all of the pain, I think it's also an opportunity for each and every one of us to radiate our own light and fill our homes with a love and with a light and with a commitment and with a depth, precisely because of the challenging times. And let's remember, as Jews, we have been around for many thousands of years through crazy, crazy challenges and circumstances. Holocausts and pogroms and auto de face till the recent massacre of October 7th. And there have been tools that have been time tested, because all the empires that tried to destroy us are gone, got literally gone. And those tools have been spiritual connection, unity, faith, prayer, what we call Torah, mitzvahs. Of course, in addition to the physical need to protect ourselves and protect our homeland. So don't underestimate these powerful tools to bring into your home and your children. Because they the proof is in the pudding. We have outlived Hitlers and Stalins and crusaders and tyrants and dictators who literally wanted to annihilate the Jewish people and came close to extinguishing the Jewish flame, as Hamas today, and unfortunately many millions want to. So I tell all of us, you know, let's strengthen chazak v'niz chazak. Let's strengthen each other. Send love to our brothers and sisters and ask ourselves every day, you know, what did I do today and how can I create this day, a day filled with much more spiritual power, much more mitzvahs, much more Torah, much more prayer, much more love. And we will bring in a lot of healing and redemption into the world. And thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ablon. Thank you, Rabbi YY. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And next time around, we should meet under better circumstances. But this was amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Amen. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
This class is brought to you by the yeshiva.net. Please help us continue the classes. make even a small contribution at www.theyeshiva.net/donate.